my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker.
Good old Jim.
He's our very own Jim. And he's going to sit right up here.
No, that's all right. We sat down.
Are you sure?
Yeah, for a while.
Okay, all right.
I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. I was not scheduled to speak tonight. This is a last-minute thing because the lady that was going to share had car trouble on the way down here and was stuck in Fowler, and Bill asked me to substitute. And I'm not really organized for this, but I'll do my best. I had a serious cardiac event 3 months ago that left me a little weak, and if I get a little faint, I'm going to sit down and finish my pitch in this chair over here by prearrangement with Bill. I got sober on July 26, 1977. So I've got about 38 and a half years of sobriety. I probably got sober before most of you were born. I was 39 years old when I got sober. I spoke here about 2 years ago, I think, a year and a half ago, and I started my pitch with my sobriety because in the past when I got to talking about my drinking career or what started my alcoholism, I ended up not getting much of my sobriety story in, but tonight I'm going to try to kind of put the two together. I was born in northeast New Jersey. Brought up in a commuter town. My dad worked in New York City and commuted to the city and back every day. I can't blame my family for my alcoholism. I think I can blame the genes I got from my mother's side of the family, but nobody in my immediate family had a problem with alcohol. My parents were social drinkers. That means that maybe once or twice a month they'd have a drink before dinner. To this day, I still don't understand having one drink before dinner. Why bother, you know? I do know I had some cousins. The only time I saw people drunk, my cousins would make the rounds of the relatives on Christmas Eve, and they'd show up at our house anywhere between 10 at night and 2 in the morning on Christmas Eve, half smashed and you know, full of good cheer. And they were entertaining. I remember that. But all of the people in my family were very well adjusted, very well educated, very smart, very capable people, and I was a little screw up. I don't know why, but it's just the way it was. I did odd things. For instance, when I was 5, parents had left us with a babysitter, and she was in the kitchen preparing for dinner. It was Sunday evening, and we were going to have pancakes for supper, and she left the pancake griddle, you know, one of those ones that open like that, on the table in the dining room, and I remember walking around the table and looking at that and thinking, boy, I bet that's hot. And I walked about 10 steps by, and for whatever reason to this day, I don't know, I went that back and put my hand right on the grill. Instant. Man, blister. Boy, did that hurt. But I had no idea why I did that. And I instantly became afraid of myself, you know. My mother would take me and my sister into New York City when she went shopping, and she'd, on the way home, when you could do this back then, she'd let us out at the New York side of the George Washington Bridge, which is about a mile long, and let us walk across the bridge, and I'd get terrified that I might get in the middle of the bridge and just compulsively throw myself over the, you know, and I just, heights terrify me because of that. But so I was an odd little guy. I got plenty of stories like that that demonstrate that point, and I don't know why I was like that. Well, I was a little scrawny kid. I got picked on a lot. I got bullied a lot. My older and my younger, so I was sandwiched between two perfect sisters. They got straight A's almost up to the end of college, and I was anywhere between an A and an F student, somewhere averaged out around C, I think. And so I had a complex there about that. I had low self-esteem. But, you know, I was just an alcoholic. I was just getting prepared to be an alcoholic, I guess. When I started drinking, I forgot about all those things and didn't make any difference. And in fact, I turned into Superman. But there wasn't much drinking in high school or in that town, mainly because there weren't. I don't even know where there was a liquor store. We had one bar in town in Glen Rock, and that was downtown. And whenever I asked about it, my parents would tell me I didn't need to know what went on there. And liquor stores would lose their license if they sold to liquor to people under the age of 21. So in high school, it was the same thing. It was in a neighboring town, but it was just as strict. They were all upper middle class people. And I remember, though, I had no interest in drinking. I had gotten an interest in jazz, you know, the old 40s jazz in those days, and I talked to a bunch of guys in my class. I had become a jock by that time. The way that happened was I got tired of having sand kicked in my face, and in seventh grade, I sent away for the Charles Atlas bodybuilding course from the back of a comic book. And I religiously did those exercises every morning, and then I switched peer groups and got in with the jocks and the popular guys. So that worked. And I talked them into going into New York City to hear Lionel Hampton play at a jazz club in Manhattan. And we all went in New York. The drinking age was 18, but I think there were about 7 or 8 of us. They all ordered drinks all night long, and I ordered milk at 75 cents a glass, which was the same as the cost of a drink. But I asked about that, and they said, well, you're going to pay the same thing as you'd pay if you were drinking. So I drank milk all night, and I ended up going off to an all-men's college, Lehigh University, for my first semester, and it was all men at that time, 3,000 guys, and they all drank, a lot of them drank really hard. They used to have a fall weekend that was 3 weeks long and a spring weekend where girls from all up and down the East Coast would come to this big party that they had every year. And then they'd move all the men into one side of the dormitories, and they'd put guards up and put the women on the other side. And I saw lots of drunks that night, and lots of funny things, but I didn't drink myself. I just thought they were funnier than hell. And one guy was tried to get in the girls' side by climbing up a drain spout, you know, rain. He got 2 floors up, and the spout came off the building. And he wrote it down slow motion. I just thought that was great. Anyway, I didn't have any desire to drink. I didn't see the point. I just didn't give it much thought. I switched. My grades were so bad that my dad had been transferred to a manufacturing plant in Memphis, Tennessee, and he thought it might be better if I was closer to home, and he asked around, and somebody told him the University of Mississippi was the Harvard of the South, and I hope nobody was from there, but it was a little better than our high school, if that. But nobody drank there either, because it was in a dry county. The South was segregated at the time, and it was a dry, and that meant all the southern states, except for bootleg booze, which was where you got your hard liquor, all you could do was drink 3.2 beer if you were in a wet county or a dry county. In a dry county, you couldn't drink anything. And if you got caught transporting that stuff across the county lines, you'd go to jail. So there wasn't any drinking at the University of Mississippi. And I had a Christian rebirth experience at Lehigh, because of all my childhood, I forgot to throw something in when I was early in high school. I ended up going to the psychiatrist for 2 years over, and I was diagnosed with an obsessive compulsive personality disorder. And if you've ever seen the television show Monk, that's what I was like. I had all these rituals that I'd made up to appease God for some of my sins, which hit me after puberty. But today it wouldn't be anything, but back then it was, because sex wasn't an open topic and you couldn't talk to anybody about it. And I'd gotten all this guilt, and I guess I made up this system of penance or something for myself. And my mother noticed I was acting strangely, and she asked me one night if I'd said, "You don't look very happy. Would you like to go talk to somebody about it?" And I thought, okay. So it took them 2 years to drag out of me what it was that I was feeling so guilty about. But so anyway, I had all these complexes from my childhood, and they were catching up with me at Lehigh, and some guy invited me to a revival meeting at a Brethren church in downtown Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and I made an altar call, gave my life to Jesus. I'm not preaching here. I'm just telling you a story. This is my story. Actually, what happened was, I was feeling really guilty. I had gotten over that system of penance, but I didn't mean I got rid of the guilt and everything, and all of my crap from my childhood. And the minister, in essence, said, you know, if you walk out of this church tonight and a brick falls out of the building and hits you on the head and you die, where are you going to go? Are you going to go to heaven, or are you going to go to hell? So I made an altar call. And actually, something did happen then. But because I quit some behavior automatically, I didn't even mean to, but it just stopped. But then I picked up some more guilt, some more pressure, because now I had this new morality that I knew I wasn't going to be able to live up to. God, that was awful. On that, then conflict got really bad. And when I switched to the University of Mississippi, this girl that I was holding Bible study with on campus, often it was just the two of us, the South was the Bible Belt, and I didn't know that. I mean, everybody'd heard religion their whole lives down there, and I thought this was all new. I was going to convert all these people. And she wanted to arrange for me to go to a camp in Colorado, where I guess I was in the Youth for Christ movement. I didn't know that, but I guess I was in it, because that's where all these kids staffed the camp, way up in the Colorado Rockies, about 35 miles outside of Colorado Springs. And my dad and I fought over that. And finally, after 2 months, he gave in and gave me $40 and said, if you can get there on this, you can go. I didn't get. It was $40 was enough for a one-way ticket to Colorado Springs. I really didn't give that much thought till after I got sober. There must have been a message in that. So I spent the summer there, and every Wednesday night, the kids that worked in the camp, all we got was room and board. We didn't get any pay. There was a minister that spoke for the people that worked, the kids that worked at the camp. They were college kids. And we had to go every Wednesday night. Now, tell me I'm not an alcoholic. Out of all those meetings, it was like an AA speakers meeting, but it was a Christian minister from somewhere. I don't know where they got these guys, but this one his whole pitch was on how Jesus led him to believe that drinking was all right, because by going down to the corner bar and having a beer with the boys, he could save those poor souls for Jesus. And I thought, what a concept. Hey, what an idea. And my mind went like this. If I don't know what the other side of life is like, how am I ever going to help people on the other side of life? Good alcoholic thinking, right? So I went home, talked to my minister about it, and he said, tried to work with too many alcoholics with too little success to recommend that if you don't drink now, that you start drinking. And I walked out of his office thinking he didn't understand what I was trying to say here. I'm going to save those poor drunks for Jesus. And here I am, I'm saving those poor drunks for... God has a real sense of humor. I never thought of that before. Anyway, I sent my girlfriend a letter that night. She wasn't my girlfriend, this girl that I did Bible studies with. She sent me back a 6-page letter. All I remember is she said, "I know if you decided to do this, there's nothing I can do to stop you." And I have no idea why she said that, except she must have had some alcoholics in her family someplace and had heard this kind of logic before. But so about, I switched to my third college in my junior year, and for whatever reason, and I don't know why until today, except I think that was part of my decision. You know, I saw guys I knew drinking. They drank in Memphis. You could drink hard liquor. The only restriction you could have in Memphis was that if you went out to a nightclub, which a lot of people did, you had to bring your own booze. They'd serve you the setups, but you had to bring your own bottle of booze with you. So, and then I think they lowered the drinking age to 18 by that time. So, in my junior year, I made a decision to start drinking. And I looked up a guy on campus. There was a guy on campus. He transferred in his junior year. And I wanted to be just like him. He was my alter ego. He was the kind of guy I wanted to be. And I decided to get to know him, to see how he was, how he became what he was, and how to be like he was. And we made friends, and he liked to drink. And we decided a good place to drink would be a fraternity. And so there were 6 little fraternities on this campus of this Presbyterian liberal arts college that we were in. And so we found the one where they drank the most, and they made us, in their junior year, they made us the president and the vice president of their next pledge class. And our only criteria was how much you could drink. You know, if you could drink a lot, you got the white ball in the box. If you couldn't, you got the black ball. And after we graduated, I guess we did a good job, because they shut down that fraternity. They kicked half the kids out, and they put the other half on probation, we learned later on. So we did our job. Anyway, but that starting to drink was the worst, you know, it was a bad decision. I never drank normally. Well, I guess I did on it when I couldn't get enough, but for most of the time, when I started drinking, I wanted to continue to drink until I passed out. And that was pretty much it for the next 20 years. I didn't have to drink all the time, but whenever I had that first drink, I just never wanted to stop with that. And so I call that alcoholic drinking. And there's lots of adventures in my drinking career, but I don't have the time. So I'm at halfway mark here. The odd thing is it seems like almost all my life, even from when I started drinking, I knew something about AA. I remember there was a movie in 1947 called I'll Cry Tomorrow with Susan Hayward, and it was the life story of Lillian Roth, who drank herself down to the bottom and then got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for whatever reason, I hadn't was just a kid, I remembered that story. When I got out of college, I joined the service, and I was married, had two kids at the time. I was in the Air Force for 4 years in San Antonio, and I took them to see Days of Wine and Roses at the drive-in theater. You cannot imagine how guilty I felt sitting through that movie, and I was just praying that my wife could not see how that movie was making me feel. I mean, really. I did not enjoy that movie at all. So that was another AA message early in my drinking. And then there was a guy that worked across the hall in the pulmonary lab. I worked in the hospital there at Lackland. And he'd come in and he'd look really ragged, beat up for, you know, weeks on end. And then all of a sudden he'd start looking good. And he'd look good for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. And he'd look rotten again for another 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. And this, I watched this cycle, and I thought, one day I went in and I said, you know, you look really rotten for a little while, and then you start looking really, really good, and then you look rotten again. I said, what's your problem? And he says, oh, well, the times that I look really good, I'm going to AA meetings. So I got to see that in action. Those things stuck in my mind. And when I got out of the service, I got involved in the business world, and I worked my way up. Best part of my drinking was anywhere from probably 6 years. You know, I got sick a lot in my first 6 years. And the room spinning thing and trying to put your foot on the floor so you don't spin around anymore and all that crap. I went through all that. And then I stopped getting sick, and then my capacity for drinking went up, and the best part of my drinking was the middle 10 years. And God, I could come home and start drinking, and I'd get in that euphoric state for 2 or 3 hours, and it was just I loved it there. I solved all the world problems. I made all these great plans. Everything, you know. It was wonderful. And then, of course, I'd pass out, and I'd wake up the next morning, and I couldn't remember anything. So I'd have to get there again the next night to remember what it was the night before. And that's pretty much the way I drank for that 10-year period. And then alcohol turned on me. I ended up, my wife ended divorcing me 4 years before I got sober, after we had moved here, and I'd gotten hooked up. Now, I was preceded the drug culture. I preceded the 60s. So I never was involved with drugs. But I got hooked up with this little alcoholic addict woman. I'd been praying for a girlfriend. She became the obsession of my life. I met her over right down the street here in Senior Flintstones. And when that back when that, there was a lot of action there, and I had a spiritual awakening the night I met her that told me I was going to meet her. So I went out and ended up there, and there was this little girl at the end of the bar who just looked angrier than hell, and she looked like I felt. And I said, I'm going to go down and get to know her because I want to know what she's so angry at. So I went down there, and she chased me away. She said, get out of here. And I was standing back at a post about 10 feet behind her. She turned around, and then she motioned me to come up. And that started a really rocky four-year relationship that led me right into AA. It really did. I had started to pray about my predicaments about 7 years before I got sober, and all these, this whole sequence of events led me to her and threw her right up into AA. I think what did it was, you know, she had used a lot of drugs. She said she never used any intravenously, but when I met her, I didn't know this until after we got together, and I discovered it as we went along because she hid it from me. But she'd get up in the morning and have a couple of beers, and then she'd smoke a joint, and then she'd get going too slow, so she'd take some speed, and then she'd get going too fast, and she'd take some Valium, and then she'd get going too, she'd get too relaxed, so she'd have some more beer and smoke another joint, and the whole cycle went on all of the time. And I thought, boy, that's a hell of a lot of work. You know, and you'd have to go to your connection, and all I had to do was walk across to a liquor store. I mean, so anyway, she beat me up one night. Oh, before she beat me up. She come home one. She called me. I was divorced, paying alimony and child support to my first wife. I leased this house on the corner of Court and Giddings. This is now a law office where we were going to live happily ever after. But guys with guns started showing up, and I knew that I was going to lose my job if the police ever raided it and found all the drugs there. So I moved to a place on Rinaldi, which is about 3 blocks away, just so I could be close in case she needed me. And I laugh at that song, that new song, Superman Has Nothing on Me. I was Superman at the time. I was there in case she needed me. And she called me up one morning and said, Jimmy, I need help. She said, I said, what happened? She said, hey, Mark, I went out and got really drunk last night, and I came home and got my .22, and I was going to shoot my kids and shoot myself. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, I passed out before I could do that, and I need help. So we hooked her up with her counselor, and she had a counselor from before, and he put her in Tulare County. He used to have a detox center over in Tulare. Put her in there to dry out, and she was there for a week, and I just got fascinated about what she went through while she was sobering up. I went every day. That's the first time I ever saw a big book, because I gave her a big book. She did sneak some pot in. When they weren't in the room, she'd open her window and stick her head out the window and take it. But I didn't know that wasn't part of the, that was part of the deal, but and as far as I know, she stayed sober for 2 months. And I'm running out of time, sorry. I knew this would happen. But I'm just here to entertain you anyway. So she went to meeting at Pine Manor for about 2 months. Well, I wasn't living with her, but I was around her that whole time. And as far as I know, she didn't drink for 2 months, and that really, really impressed me. And she'd come home from the meetings, and she'd tell me there were She told me there were people that owned pet stores there, had their own businesses, and there were lawyers there, and there was a doctor there. And she was trying to tell me, because I had a professional job, that there were people like me there. That's what she was trying to say. She was trying to carry the message to me indirectly. But the big change came is, she did beat me up once. I won't go through that story, but I was never going to see her again, and I was at work about 5 days later, and my black eye had turned greenish, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and she called, and she wanted to know, she said, well, you want to try marriage counseling? And I said, yeah, sure, that sounds interesting. We weren't married, but that's why it was so intriguing about it. So we went down to mental health, which was in a motel on Mooney at the time. And the first question that her counselor asked her, are you going to quit drinking? And she said, yeah, I'm not just going to drink beer. And he said, that's not what I asked you. I said, are you going to quit drinking? She said, I told you, I'm not going to drink, I'm just going to drink beer. And he said, oh, if that's the case, then get out of here. I don't want to work with you. So I went to counseling for 37 weeks by myself. And marriage counseling by myself to a woman I wasn't even married to. Right? Anyway, after 37 weeks, I said, look, just tell me what to do. We're not making much headway here. And the counselor says, well, get rid of her and quit drinking. So I went home and I got rid of her. She took the car and her kids and went to Illinois. I came back the next week and said, okay, I got rid of her. And he said, now quit drinking. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, you don't want to go to AA, do you? And I said, no, I don't want to go to AA. So that was our last session. And on his way out, he stopped and said, well, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to go home. It's been a tough day, and I'm going to go home and have a couple of really good martinis. And that was a year before I got sober. But she came back. She didn't want to spend winter in Illinois. And I was missing her. But I was in terrible shape about that time, and this is how I got into AA. I'm sorry I don't have enough time to tell you how I got sober, but anyway, it was God's doing. I told you about that plan, that 7-year plan God had to get me into AA. Well, this was all working its way out. And so that I could help those people on the other side of life, you know. So about 6 weeks before probably 6 or 8 weeks before I got sober, I was in terrible shape on a Saturday afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was all curled up on the bed in our apartment on Rinaldi, and I was just miserable. I was in the fetal position, and she came walking into the room, and she said, Jimmy, you're going to turn into a derelict and a lonely old man. And those words just cut right to the quick with me. I just knew the truth of those words, but I still didn't have the power to do anything about it. And the next weekend on Saturday, I was in the same condition on the same bed. Now, she was not religious. She used to ridicule my faith and ridicule me over my faith, but she just came in and stood at the foot of the bed and took one look, and with all this pity in her voice, she said, Jimmy, I pray to Jesus that you stop drinking. And it was like God was praying through her, because it just hit me. I mean, I knew the sincerity of her words, even though she didn't believe in the God she was praying to. So about a week later, I was sitting, gotten up early in the morning, and there was an empty room, and I was sitting in there, and I was overwhelmed with this. I had a spiritual experience, and it said, "Leave her. You'll never get sober here." So I walked into the bedroom, and I said, "I'm leaving." And she didn't say anything. She didn't object. I just left, and I moved into the Oak Tree Inn. If anybody remembers where the Oak Tree Inn was, it was over across from COS. It was a really, the back part was built in the 1930s, where all the alcoholics and addicts lived. And I moved into one of those rooms. It was $70 a month. I was the accounting manager of the Western Area operations of a national company. I was hitchhiking to work with my employees. I had to borrow my son's 10-speed bike because she had the only car that we owned, and she wasn't about to give it to me, and I didn't want her to know where I was anyway, so I spent a month in the Oak Tree Inn. It was the blackest month of my life. It was really dark. There were some really ugly things that just coincidentally happened. I either saw a demon, or if it was the real thing, it was really scary. I mean, it really was. I slept with a knife under my pillow for the rest of the night. That last day there, I was really getting angry at her, and I decided the worst thing that I could do to her was to get sober. If she tried and she failed, this was my alcoholic thinking. It didn't take me very much to get drunk anymore, and I just. So I decided, living well is the best revenge. I decided I was going to get sober forever, and that was going to be the biggest put down that I could ever do. And I put every ounce of willpower and psychic energy I had into getting sober that night. And I, 3 hours later, I had to go and buy a bottle. And I was just filled with despair. I just sat down in my chair in the motel and said, "What am I going to do? What am I going to do now, God? I can't do this." And he told me what to do. I had another spiritual awakening. What he told me to do was to get up the next morning and go see this guy, the supervisor in the shop. He was older than me. He'd been coming into my office once a month for about a year, telling me about how he was getting sober in AA. And I didn't think this out. This was what this message said: go find Jack tomorrow morning, take him for a cup of coffee, and tell him that you need help, you have a drinking problem. So I finished drinking what I was drinking, I went to bed, I got up in the morning, and I did exactly what that voice told me to do. And you'll have to come back for the second edition some other weekend. But he took me to my first three AA meetings. I think the first one was a meeting was a lecture on alcoholism by Frank Ross at Pine Manor, and then he took me to a couple meetings. I can't remember because it's really foggy, but he got me started in my AA walk. And the only thing I can say is this big secret: I went to meetings for quite a while trying to figure out what the hell it was that you guys had that was going to keep me from drinking. My big story is that I had this big book in my motel room. And one Saturday morning, I was standing in the middle of the motel room, about 3 months sober, and I saw the book, and my mind said, "Gee, I bet I'm supposed to read that." And now this is a well-educated mind, you know, and I was promised myself I would do everything that they said to do, and what they said to do was to buy a big book. So I bought one, and I put it on the table by my bed. Nobody said read it. I guess that was implied. So that Saturday I sat down and read it, the first 164 pages. But the real solution was in the steps. Big Bob used to say this at meetings, and I'd heard it so many times by the time I got around to doing them then. You know, if you want to make a cake and you don't know how to make a cake, get a recipe book and follow the recipe exactly as it's written down in the cookbook. You know, measure out all the ingredients properly, mix them together in the right order, and you'll probably come up with a pretty good cake. But if you leave out any one of the ingredients, or you don't put them together in the order that the cookbook says you should, you're probably not going to come out with anything that looks like a cake. And he says, that's the steps. He said, you know, they used to tell me, me in particular, they numbered them for dummies. They wanted me to dumb down a little bit. And so that's what I did. I proceeded to work through the steps, one step at a time, doing the best, you know, working through each one exactly as I was told to do in the book, and the 12 by 12. And I worked my way, in the first year, I worked my way methodically through all 12 steps. So that gave me the spiritual toolkit I needed to face life. Now, in case this helps anybody, I don't know whether it will probably scare the hell out of you, but you know, I've been married and divorced twice in sobriety, so I haven't mastered that, and I gave up trying. I think I had three different jobs from when I started working to when I got sober, and in hell and sobriety, I've had about six different jobs, and was unemployed five times. My mom, my dad, my older sister, and my younger sister have all passed away in my sobriety. I'm 15 years sober. My kids decided they didn't want to have a relationship with me anymore, so I haven't had that relationship with them, and have had a whole variety of medical problems. Starting with my first heart attack in 1992, I've got a titanium hip and two titanium shoulders and stents all over my body, and I'm still alive at 78 and still sober. So something's been working.